An electoral comeback in Bolivia as the party of the country's exiled former president, Evo Morales, returns to power. The new leader of Canada's Green Party, whose election 2 weeks ago has marked several firsts for a national political party in Canada, outlines her vision for the party and a license to cycle. Why Berlin's police chief wants the city's speedier cyclists to sport license plates on their bikes. Monocle's editors tackle those subjects today here on the Late Edition on Monocle 24. Hello there, and a very warm welcome to you to the Late Edition here on Monocle 24. It is Tuesday, the 20th of October, and I'm Tomos Lewis here in Toronto. And joining us today are Monocle's Europe editor at large, Ed Stocker, who joins us from Milan, and from New York City, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan. Ed, Henry, great to have you both on the programme today. Ed, to start with you, you've been on your travels recently. How have they treated you?
I have indeed. I have been hopping on a train to Switzerland. Feels good to be out and about. We've got a bit of a Swiss theme to our December, January issue. So I've been interviewing some of the powers that be in Switzerland. I won't want to reveal too much, but it feels good to be able to travel for now. Having said all of that, where I am in Milan, Lombardy has seen a bit of a spike in cases, and there's currently a curfew in place between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. So no all-night raging for me at the moment, Tom.
Quite a change for you, Ed, I'd imagine, therefore. And Henry, how about you? Have you managed to stretch your legs this week so far?
Oh, yeah, no, I've been, I think I mentioned this in the show last week, I've been enjoying the use of the kind of outdoor gym at my local park, and then getting quite ripped, even if I say so myself. I do wear prophylactic gloves, so you don't need to worry about me getting contaminated by the equipment there, which I know you will, Tomos.
I've lost countless hours of sleep over at Henry, so thank you very much for the reassurance there. Henry Rees-Sheridan and Ed Stocker, great to have you both with us on the programme today. Well, before we dig in to today's discussions, let's get a roundup now of the late evening news with Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak.
Thanks, Thomas. The US government has filed a landmark lawsuit against Google today, basically for abusing its market power, particularly when it comes to its search engine. The U.S. Justice Department accuses Google of excluding other search providers, for example, from Android phones, and says that it's undermining free competition. Department says all options are on the table, including separating Google's search business from the rest of its operations, something that would essentially cut the company in half. Now, there is some precedent for this. Microsoft was taken to court for similar actions back in 1998. What's interesting in this case is the timing of all of this. Google and the power of big Silicon Valley companies is one of those rare areas of bipartisan agreement in the United States. Many on the left want them to be broken up, but they've also become something of a bogeyman on the right, where there's this perceived anti-conservative bias, particularly Google when it comes to what sources are brought up when people conduct news searches. There are some reports that U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr actually sped up this investigation, which had been running for about 14 months, to bring it just in time for the November elections. So big tech is the kind of issue that really fires up both sides of the American electorate. It's hard to see it having a major impact on the election, but either way, this lawsuit is a pretty clear sign that big tech companies in the U.S. should be worried. Both parties are pretty eager to come after them. Back to you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Chris. Well, let's begin today's programme in Bolivia, where the party of the former president, Evo Morales, has enjoyed a resounding comeback in the country's elections. Luis Arce, the candidate for Morales' Movement to Socialism party, has secured more than half of the vote. His closest rival, the centrist former president, Carlos Mesa, won less than a third. But many now assume that Morales, who remains in exile, will continue to run the government from behind the scenes. Earlier on today's edition of The Globalist, we heard from Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott, who says one of Arce's successful tactics appears to have been a major distancing of his candidacy from Morales.
During his campaign, he described Morales as a historical figure for the country, but said he wouldn't have any part in his government. So he's made it clear, at least in the run-up to the vote, that Morales isn't part of the broader picture. And in an interview last week with The Washington Post, Arce did say that Morales would need to face the justice system to defend himself against numerous charges if he did return to Bolivia, because let's remind listeners that Morales has watched all of this from Argentina. Opponents and critics have consistently claimed, though, that Arce is little more than a puppet for the exiled former president, a little like what we saw in Argentina last year when the controversial former president Kirchner, she returned to power as part of a socialist government. She actually assumed a new role as vice president to Alberto Fernandez. But many opposition politicians claim that it's actually she who's running the show. So now we have two neighboring South American countries with left-leaning governments and big polarizing political figures back in the spotlight.
Lucinda Elliott, their Monocle's correspondent in Latin America. Ed, you interviewed Evo Morales for Monocle earlier this year. What did you make of what Lucinda had to say there? Are we likely to see this towering former figure in Bolivian politics pulling the strings from his exile in Argentina, do you think?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one needs to remember the huge impact that he's had on Bolivian politics before forcibly resigning, as he'd say, in November of last year. He was in power for 14 years. So he's left a huge mark. There's lots of people who are in Bolivia who sort of grew up under him. So one must take that into account, first of all. I mean, when I did interview him, I travelled to Buenos Aires and I went to a big meeting. It was a gathering. It was thousands of people in a football stadium. And it was a sort of campaign rally, if you like. Luis Arce was there, but there was no question as to who was taking center stage. It was all about Evo Morales there. And he sort of got onto the stage and flowers were put around his neck. He really has galvanized the indigenous population, the Andean indigenous population in Bolivia, and a lot of those people love him. And so it's hard to know now how much influence he will have. Certainly, Arce was his sort of anointed candidate. He was a compromise candidate. He's not from the social base of this sort of umbrella organization, the movement to socialism. So not everyone was happy with this candidacy. He was educated in the UK. He's a former economy minister under Morales. Having said all of that, and like Lucinda said, he did make certain moves to distance himself from Evo Morales, but he was also part of the Evo Morales government. So it will be interesting to see. Yes, Morales has been in Buenos Aires, so he's been out of action, if you like. He's been trying to be involved in Bolivian politics, but from a distance further south. He was in Mexico before heading finally to Buenos Aires. During the interim government of Jeanine Añez, it was clearly impossible for him to return. He was told that he would be arrested for fraud, amongst other things, if he were to return to Bolivia. Obviously, if Arce is installed, and it seems highly likely, and he's won, according to two exit polls, over 50% of the vote, but one has to say that there still isn't, at this stage, an official result, it would seem that he would return to the country triumphantly. It must be added, too, that he did want to stand as a senator in this recent election, but the interim government invalidated his candidacy, saying that he wasn't resident in Bolivia and therefore couldn't stand. So at the very least, I think that he will return to politics in some guise, perhaps as a senator. Whether he pulls the strings behind the government, we'll have to see, but he still clearly has some ambitions for politics, I'd say.
And Ed, just a brief final thought on Bolivia's election results. You described before we came to air that Bolivia is a polarised place politically at the moment. Do you think this result does anything to build bridges in that regard, do you think?
Well, I think it could have been a lot worse. And I say we'll have to wait for this electoral tribunal to give the final results, because that body, without going into too much detail, because it's complex, was evolved involved in a lot of controversy back in November in terms of the way the results were presented. This time around, it hasn't given a snapshot sort of projection of what's going to happen. It's allowed the exit polls to do that, but it itself hasn't made a pronouncement. It's waiting for a more concrete result to try and avoid some of those problems. What I would say is that Carlos Mesa, the centrist who came second, has acknowledged this victory. So too has Deneen Añez. So we've got two central figures in Bolivian politics who are in opposition to Morales and Arce, who've acknowledged the results and have congratulated the MAS coalition. So that's good news for the healing of wounds. Having said that, we did see a big shift to the right during the interim government. There were several incidents of violence. So we don't want to see a return to that. At least for the moment, politicians are acting in the right way. And let's hope in the long term, the country can heal those wounds that have been exposed over the last year or so.
Well, next here on The Late Edition, the Green Party of Canada elected a new leader a little more than 2 weeks ago. Annamie Paul is a former lawyer and a relative newcomer to national politics here in Canada. But she is the first woman of colour and the first Jewish person to lead a national political party here. And while the Greens have only 3 members in Canada's parliament, the party's presence has been growing in local and provincial legislatures across the country during the past few years. I spoke to Annamie Paul in Toronto last week on her ambitions for Canada's Green Party, and she began by outlining her own experience and how it might frame her approach as the Green Party's new leader.
My story is definitely an immigrant story here in Canada. My mom and my grandma came here as domestic workers, which is really the only way that Black women could come to Canada back then. And they were both already skilled professionals, but that's how you could come. And we lived incredibly modestly because a lot of money, you know, you make money, but then you send it back home to just 1 million people. And so I grew up very modestly, but in a place where, well, in a family where that had high expectations and in a place where it was entirely possible for someone with my background to get a great education and then to have an affordable post-secondary education. And so both of those things are harder now. And that's a big problem.
The leadership election to succeed your predecessor, Elizabeth May, who had been the leader of Canada's Green Party for 14 years or so, that was a crowded field. And it was a process that was drawn out by the coronavirus pandemic, among other things. What effect do you feel that had on your own campaign and then on your victory back at the beginning of this month?
For us, when the pandemic hit, we immediately pivoted because for me, you know, look, I haven't been in politics long, but it's one of the things that it's very important for people to remember, and certainly I want to never forget it, is that, you know, people need to remember we are part of the community, you know, we're not apart from it. So if people are having, and the people they love are having difficulties because of the pandemic in terms of their employment, in terms of seeing their elderly parents, if they're in long-term care, in terms of all the things we were panicked about, it affected me as well. And so I said to our campaign team, the only logical way that we can continue with this campaign and not call for it to be suspended is if we are contributing positively to the conversation about how to get through this moment and then what comes afterward. And so we spent a lot of time in the first, 4 months of the campaign talking about that, and particularly about how to prevent people from falling through the cracks, the people that still were not going to be covered by these benefits and other things, you know, for instance, asylum seekers. I mean, we've closed our border to asylum seekers coming via the United States, and that to me is unconscionable. And so that was the role that I said we could play. And so that's what we did. And then toward the end, you know, when things had stabilized, we went back to the climate emergency and the environment and talking about that. So the two big parts were how we can address the gaps in our social safety net and finally complete it. And the other big part was how we can deal with this existential crisis, which is the climate emergency.
Green parties in many countries, of course, have big contrasts between them. But speaking in broad terms, do you think that the green parties, green agendas, have struggled to break through into the mainstream when it comes to national elections? And I suppose I'm interested to know what would a tipping point for the election en masse of green MPs in Canada's national parliament, what would that tipping point look like?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an excellent question. And I'm always asking my partner about tipping points, because that's exactly where he works. He works at the tipping point, you know, between, let's say, civil war or authoritarian regimes or deadly conflict and peace. And it's very hard to know what the elements are. But there are some things that I'll say that I noticed anecdotally about green parties and where we've made breakthroughs. It normally seems to be at moments of significant disruption. It can be something domestic, it can be something global, but something that is sufficiently disruptive and sufficiently insufficiently addressed by the usual suspects, the usual, you know, parties that have been, you know, elected and reelected, etc., that people are willing to take that final leap. Because in our country and in lots of countries, you know, Greens are well regarded. There's a significant percentage of people who are willing to consider voting Green. In our country, over a third of people have said that they would consider voting Green, and we're the top second choice of the other parties' voters. We have got to demonstrate we are ready to govern. I think that there is still some reticence or some suspicion that perhaps we have great ideas, but that we're not professional enough. We're not disciplined enough to be able to execute them. So that is a big part of the role that I have, making sure that people see that we are those things and that our house is in order, so that if they do give us their confidence and a bigger role, we are able to do something impactful with it. And they don't need to keep voting for the parties that keep stealing our ideas. They can actually go to the original with the confidence that we can get the job done on their behalf.
And your election to lead Canada's Green Party has marked several firsts for a leader of a national political party in Canada. What's your hope that the breaking of some of those boundaries, the creation of some of those firsts, as you have done in your election to the leadership, what do you think that might mean for politics in Canada, national politics, in the years to come?
You know, the research tells us it makes a difference. It's not just a sensation that people have. People associate themselves and participate in institutions where they see themselves reflected. And so having someone like me in a position like this makes it possible for those people who did not see that before, who couldn't imagine it before, to actually imagine it. And that's really, really important in a country as diverse as Canada. It's really important for the health of our democracy. It's one of the things that we just have to confront and really grapple with. We have to ask ourselves why in 2020, I'm only the fifth woman to lead a major federal party. Only the fifth. We're talking about 52% of our population who has only had five leaders. And so this is an area, it's one of our final frontiers in politics, and it is as impenetrable in general as it has been in the United States. We like to think of ourselves as being different in that respect, but we absolutely are not. We just simply are not. We're going to do what is necessary to make all people in Canada feel welcome and included in politics. And this helps. This definitely helps, not just in terms of the Green Party, but it helps in general.
That was Annamie Paul, the new leader of the Green Party of Canada, speaking to me here in Toronto last week. Henry, listening to that, Annamie Paul there said that she, in effect, wanted voters who want the climate emergency, as she described it there, to be front and centre of their government's priorities. She wanted those voters to come back to the source, as she said it. Is that an effective message, do you think, in terms of the climate, politically and otherwise, that we're in at the moment in many places?
Yeah, I think an interesting question is, as mainstream political parties, certainly on the left, and even in European countries, to some extent on the right, develop a kind of more and more detailed environmental platforms and co-opt more of the Green parties, the historical Green parties' agendas, into their platforms. What do Green parties have to offer voters when often perceptions of their ability to govern when it comes to other issues, are that they will not be as competent as more traditional political parties. Just to give a kind of illustration of this from North America, you know, in the US, the Green New Deal, which is now very famous, has been on the platforms of Green Party candidates in that country since 2006. But the person who's profited most from it and who is most closely associated with that idea is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a Democrat. And I think that's just an example of how, you know, people who are members of mainstream political parties have co-opted very specific policy positions developed within Green parties and made it their own to a point that it's no longer even associated with the Green parties that gave birth to them. It's difficult for me to see the Green parties establishing themselves as being the most credible holistic governing option among all the alternatives in the mind of voters. On the other hand, you know, environmental causes are only going to get more pressing, I think, in the minds of voters as we go forward. So there may be some room for growth there.
Well, you can read more about Annemie Paul in the December-January issue of Monocle magazine, which will be out in a few weeks' time. Well, finally here on today's programme, bike ridership in many cities may have received a welcome bump during the pandemic, but it's put some city authorities in a spin, if you'll see what I did there. Police in Berlin are reportedly considering a proposal that would require cyclists to attach licence plates to their bicycles in response to the high number of accidents involving cyclists in Germany's capital city. Well, Monocle's Nick Manise had more on the story for us on today's edition of The Briefing.
Berlin's police chief, Barbara Slowick, which is a great name for someone concerned about people riding fast in cities, she said that, I guess, or pointed to the fact that cyclists cause more than half the accidents they're involved in, which is to be expected, often because they've strayed out of their designated lanes. And I'd say that there's a couple of things at play here, less to do with the cyclists. I'm not saying that, I mean, you've got bad drivers, you've got bad cyclists, I'm sure you've got bad pedestrians. But, I mean, firstly, it points to the fact that our cities and our streets are designed for cars first and foremost. And if more people are riding, the infrastructure isn't there to keep up with. The second thing that I would point to, Andrew, is that, and I'm passionate at trying to convert you here, is that bike riders are good for everybody. They slash congestion, they lower pollution, the death tolls are significantly lower
this
when people are on the road. So I think licensing them perhaps makes people less inclined to ride because you start to add these bureaucratic hoops that people have to jump through.
Nick Manise there, speaking to Andrew Muller on The Briefing today. Ed, license plates on bicycles, a bureaucratic hoop, as Nick put there, or a good idea, do you think?
I mean, are they going to actually have these sort of clunky number plates you're going to have to tack on the back of a bike? I'm just wondering what that's going to look like. But I have to agree with Nick, actually, to be honest with you. I mean, from the point of view of the rider, at least, I can't see what would be particularly advantageous. I mean, perhaps I can understand a city wanting in a way to monitor it, but I think it could potentially discourage people if they do have to do something. It takes away also from this idea that I've sort of felt being not a lone cyclist, but slightly renegade in New York City, where it is a slightly frightening experience where I used to live. That feeling of sort of freedom of being on a bike, if you suddenly have to complete all this paperwork to get on it, then it seems a little bit too much to me. So I think you should allow riders to do their thing, and perhaps you need to, like Nick says, make sure the infrastructure is really up to speed to allow them to stick within rules adequately.
And Henry, what's your take on this? And what kind of cyclist would you describe yourself as? Are we talking yellow jersey here or stabilisers?
My stabilisers were removed over a year ago at this stage. So
congratulations,
I think I represent a kind of third way between those two binaries that you described. I don't mind the idea of some kind of registration mechanism for the sake of accountability. I wouldn't like to see that spill over into requiring cyclists to have insurance, because I do think that would penalise people who want to use this environmentally advantageous and also, you know, cheap form of transportation. I think that should be encouraged. I think that if you're going to have a registration mechanism, it needs to be accompanied by an increase in cycle infrastructure, as Nick stated, which might actually solve many of the problems that are causing people to call for registration in the first place. And there needs to be an increase in the amount of respect that is shown to cyclists on the road too. I'm a cyclist in New York, as Ed has been, and it is absolutely harrowing here. There's been a ton of deaths in the last 2 years, which has led to a kind of investment in cycle infrastructure in pockets of the city. But it's just bizarre, like cycle lanes start in the middle of roads, end in the middle of roads. There doesn't seem to have been any centralised planning at all. Sorry, Ed, go on.
I actually think it's quite good. My experience of 6 years in New York is I'm pretty happy with the bike lanes. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you happen to cycle down a dark street in the West Village, you may end up hitting a lunar-sized pothole and flipping over the handlebars, which has happened to me. But it's better in like London are these tiny little cycle lanes, and in Milan you have to sort of hop onto a pavement, avoid tram lines. So compared to those, I don't know. I was quite happy with New York anyway. Just saying.
Yeah, I don't spend as much time cycling around the West Village at night as you, so maybe I'm missing out on the best cycle lanes. But I had concluded what I was saying. I have nothing more to add to that. But I appreciate Ed's coda.
Well, the back alleys and the back streets of the West Village, a story to come here in the coming weeks on the Late Edition. But for now,
next week,
Ed and Henry, stay safe in your saddles in your respective parts of the world. Thank you to the two of you for being with us on the programme today. Our studio manager today was Sam Impey. A big thanks to her, as always, too. The Late Edition returns at the same time tomorrow. But for more news, more discussion and much more too, do stay with us here at Monocle 24. I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.